At KUOW's The Record, I'm Bill Radke, wishing you happy travels if moving around is in your future this week. If you take light rail to SeaTac and you get off at Airport Station, you might believe that you are at the airport. You are not. You still have a five-minute walk to get to the entrance. That little jaunt will take you through a walkway that, in the winter months, can be cold, can be wet. The Port of Seattle wants you to use light rail more, so they're investing in money to making that five-minute walk more comfortable. Price tag, $3.5 million. Brian DeRoy is a spokesman for the Port of Seattle who will be responsible for the changes. He joins us from a hallway at Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. Brian, welcome to The Record.
Yeah, good to be here. Good to be here.
Before we get to the new walkway, I want to ask, why doesn't our light rail system connect to the airport?
Well, it does connect to the airport. It is an engineering issue why it doesn't drop people off directly in front of the terminal. And that is because when this terminal was built back in the late 40s, they made it in almost a boomerang shape. So the original building is not straight. It is kind of in a boomerang shape. So when we added on to the building, in subsequent additions throughout the years, that boomerang just continued. And as a result, we have a boomerang-shaped building, and we have a parking ramp in front of our building that is also similarly shaped. So because of that, Sound Transit, their cars, their train cars, could not pull in to the airport in and make that sharp of a turn. So that's why the Sound Transit operation is adjacent to our parking ramp. But it's still adjacent to our parking ramp, and it's still pretty darn close to the airport. If you go to other major cities, New York, if you go to Chicago, I've taken their L system, it's just as far, if not further, of a walk than our system is here at T-Tech.
And what have travelers told you about our quarter-mile walk?
Well, this time of year from now through, of course, probably February, folks don't enjoy that walk as much because it's a little rainy. It's a little chilly at times. So we have decided now is the time to really address that, and to, as well as encouraging more people to take light rail to the airport, we are investing in some weatherproof windscreens that will block out any rain and wind on that walkway. We'll also be putting in some overhead heaters to make that area a little cozier during those cool winter nights. And also we're going to have some staff there on golf carts. So some folks who may have some accessibility issues, some elderly or disabled, they will now have an easier way to get from the station to the airport. And we expect those personnel and those golf carts to be in place, unfortunately, probably after the holidays because of just procurement and staffing reasons, but that will be happening soon.
And why not a conveyor belt, a people mover, so old and sick people can rest and you don't have to
exactly.
have golf carts?
Yeah, well, hey, that's a good question. Again, we go back to an engineering question and a design question. When the transit station was originally built, there had been plans to construct a hotel adjacent to our parking ramp. There's a small area where something could have been built. And originally, there had been a plan to have that moving walkway from the hotel go into the airport. Well, since that never happened, so as a result, the original plan was to have a moving walkway from that hotel go directly into the terminal. Well, since that did not happen, plan B was the existing Sound Transit structure to then have an overhead walkway go to the parking deck. Now, why no people mover? Why no automated walkway? That would be an additional structure that you'd have to put inside the walkway, and you wouldn't have enough ceiling clearance for people. Another problem is a seismic issue. The way the structure is engineered, you would need a lot more supports to put into that structure as well as the parking ramp. It's not designed for something that heavy. People movers are nice, but they are heavy structures. So we would actually have to build a brand new walkway with the people mover. And that's something that we're thinking about. Our commission is really aggressively thinking of how can we get people to the airport, because we're going to have 20 million more passengers here in the next 20 years.
I heard you say that SeaTac is considering a moving walkway. Would that make the new heated windscreen walkway obsolete?
Well, no. That's a longer, much longer term thing. So we're considering a lot of things. You're looking at 10 and 20 year master plan. So a lot of things are considered. So for the near term, our customers want they really deserve a better accommodation in the walkway, so that's why we're putting up the windscreens. We're doing the heating elements now. When you look at 5-10 years down the road, what can be built, is that a consideration? Of course it is. But right now, we have to do what we can today to accommodate people, to encourage more light rail usage, and we feel this is the best near-term solution.
You know, in 10 or 20 years, I'm going to need that moving walkway.
Well, you know, we'll have the golf carts going right now, so if you're out and you're playing tackle football and break the ankle or something, you know, come January, we can put you in a golf cart. We'll still get you right towards the airport.
That's my plan.
That's right.
Brian DeRoy, yes. Spokesperson at SeaTac Airport. Thanks for filling us in.
You got it. Appreciate it. Give us a shout anytime.
So the holidays are coming a little fast for them. Brian says you're going to start to see improvements in January 2017. This is KUOW's The Record. Glad to have you along. I'm Bill Radke. Maybe you heard the term gig economy, referring to people who work a series of short-term jobs here and there. The federal government says more and more Americans are part of the gig economy. Well, this is nothing new for artists who have been gigging for years. In an expensive city like Seattle, that takes real creativity, as KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman tells us.
Hosea Baug's resume is eclectic, to say the least.
I've done every job in the book, practically. I've been a deckhand on the Victoria Clipper. I've parked cars in a graveyard shift, you know.
But Baug's not some 40-year-old ne'er-do-well. He's been a professional actor for almost 20 years.
I would take my curtain call, then I would bow, take off my makeup, and then go park cars all night.
These days, Baug works as a teacher's assistant for public school special education classes. He likes the fact that he can take time off from his day job to audition for acting gigs.
There are times when we have to choose between the gig and a quote-unquote real job, and we choose the gig.
According to the advocacy group Artists Trust, more than 50,000 artists live and work in Washington State. Many of them support themselves like a Baug with a series of temporary jobs. Shannon Halberstadt directs Artist Trust. She says while the general public is just hearing about the gig economy, it's nothing new for artists.
They'll mix different income sources to be able to make a living as an artist. And so that might look like teaching. It might look like, you know, making some goods or products. That's something that they're very used to and something that they're very good at.
But moving from gig to gig is tough, especially as artists get older.
You don't have those things that are predictable, like retirement plan or insurance or those sorts of things.
Theater artist Sarah Porkalup sautés a pan of vegetables in her tiny apartment kitchen.
I'm Filipino, Chinese, and Hawaiian, and so kind of how you show people that you love them is you feed them.
Porkalup and her partner live in a one-bedroom unit on Lower Queen Anne.
I'm fortunate because my costs are small. My rent is minimal compared to a lot of my peers. Because I live in the city, I don't have a car and I don't pay insurance.
After she graduated from Cornish College of the Arts, Porkalup worked full-time as a bankruptcy specialist. She grew up poor, and financial security is very important to her. So the decision to quit her job to pursue theater full-time was tough. She loves what she does, but Porkalup says a gig-to-gig life means she works 24/7.
If I were able to log how many hours I actually spent towards working and like got paid an hourly wage, I'd be really wealthy.
For now, Porkalup and her partner will stay in their apartment. But Artist Trust Director Shannon Halberstadt says as prices in Seattle skyrocket, that may not be possible for artists who survive gig to gig.
It's harder for artists to find spaces where they can produce their work and exhibit or perform their work because space is very expensive. And so we're seeing some attrition from the city because artists can't afford to be here.
3 years ago, Hosea Baug and his wife had to leave their Capitol Hill apartment and the thriving arts community there for a cheaper townhouse in southwest Seattle.
You know, when we moved out here, it was a little alienating for me. I was like, I have to drive everywhere. But I found that, you know, within a year or two, everybody was moving out here.
Now, Baug and his wife have a second baby on the way. He knows they'll have to make trade-offs to support themselves in Seattle, but for now, Hosea Baug has no plans to move away.
I feel like, you know, if you want to go after it, the city will kind of give you what you put into it.
I'm Marcy Silman, KUOW News.
Here's an idea, whether you're an artist or not, you know, if Seattle's not fitting right, you could move to Tacoma, which is what a couple did. We're going to meet them coming up later in the show today. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You know, Washington State legalized recreational pot use under the Obama administration when it seemed like the federal government was going to look the other way. Well, Donald Trump's choice for attorney general is Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, who is a vocal opponent of legal marijuana. Now what? We're going to bring you that story coming up this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. President-elect Trump conceded today he probably won't make good on his campaign pledge to pursue a new criminal investigation of Hillary Clinton. Breitbart News reacted with the headline, "Broken Promise." Now we're going to spotlight some other kinds of reactions to Donald Trump. The day after the election, a Seattle parent named Molly Spence Sahebjami started a Facebook page called "Dear President Trump, Letters from Kids About Kindness." In the past couple of weeks, the page has gone viral with letters like this one from 9-year-old Annie Rose.
I know a lot of you are scared that Donald Trump is president, and I am too. I'm worried for my friends who are African American and my friends who are Latino. But I know that now, for these 4 years, or maybe even 8 years that Donald Trump is president, we have to stay strong. These are the times when we have to think most about what is right. We have to control our anger and remember not to speak with hate.
Sahebjami told me she started the page after her 5-year-old reacted to Trump's election.
The day after the election, my own son woke up and said, "The mean man won?" And I think that a lot of kids across the country were surprised to wake up that morning. And I talked to a lot of moms that day that were trying to answer that question, how do I explain this to my children? You know, and kids who were really upset about it. I think it's really prevalent, at least where I live in Seattle, that kids may not know, you know, they may have varying levels of understanding about all the issues as to what helped Trump win the election, but they do all share the sentiment that, boy, that was kind of the mean guy. He said some mean things about certain groups of people.
I can confirm that at my kids' school, too. Whatever you think of Trump, there was a lot of concern, including among my kids, about this idea that when the bad guy's in charge, I mean, again, right or wrong, that's a scary thought to a child.
Yeah, what does that mean? And so I think, you know, we see a lot of protests in our children. Our children have been privy to seeing some of those protests, whether on the news or seeing them live. So for us, this was a way that it was just done very instinctively. I set up this page for friends to participate in and for our children to do something productive to help us feel a little better and write letters to the president-elect. What I said to my son specifically, my son's only 5, he's in kindergarten, so he's not really distressed about this or anything, but what I said to him was, well, you know, when someone's unkind, you can talk to them. You're good at being kind. Why don't we try to help him? And so I was saying that to myself sort of cynically, but we did it. We wrote a letter, and then other kids have written letters too. And I think it has helped them to feel that they're taking a role in the democracy in a productive way.
Let's start with your child. What effect has it had on him to go from being worried about the mean man to writing the possibly mean man a kind letter?
My child was, as I say, he's only 5, he's in kindergarten, so I don't want to overblow what his distress was over the election compared to older kids that I know. But I think what it did do for him was help him feel empowered, and he felt that that was a cool thing. He's definitely very aware of President Obama and the First Lady, and he's aware of what it means to be the President of the United States and what a powerful position that is and the impact that it has on all of us, that he's the leader of our country. So I think it really helped him to say, well, I can do this. I can write to him, and I can tell him how I feel. It's really important to be kind, and I hope that he can be kind.
One of the letter writers was 13-year-old Hadley, who wrote, "Dear Mr. Trump, I hope that during your presidency you can defy my expectations. I hope since many people dislike you, you can prove us wrong." Respectfully, yeah. Hadley. I don't know many people who want to be proved wrong. That's some wisdom there.
Yeah. Well, you know, our president, Trump has won the election in a democratic process, and, you know, he's our president, and he has a responsibility to all of us, I think, to show us that he can set a tone and help the country and help all of the people that are pretty nervous about some of the things that he said and some of the things that are happening.
Tomas writes, "Dear Mr. Trump, I think you should be nice to people from other countries and people that are gay. I would especially appreciate it if you were especially nice to them. Love, Tomas. P.S. My mommies are gay."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've had a lot of different perspectives on the page from all kinds of people, all kinds of kids in different situations, with different groups of friends, some personal worry for groups of friends or for their own families. My husband's family has a lot of Muslims in it. He's of Iranian descent. And so my 5-year-old's letter said to be kind and that there are people in our family that are of a certain religion and they are not bad guys. So to me, that it was powerful. And I think that a lot of the other letters have been just really powerful, speaking from a personal standpoint of who we are as Americans and this nation of immigrants that we are.
I was struck by the sign-offs in the notes I saw. Respectfully, Hadley. Love, Tomas. Warm regards from Kayla. Do you think these kids feel love and respect and warm regards toward Trump, or are they being little diplomats?
I think that a lot of us feel worry about some of the things that President Trump is doing, but we also want to show respect for the office, and we do have respect for the office. And so, I mean, I think that's what this movement is about, is respectfully voicing our concerns and participating in democracy. I mean, what more American thing is there than kids writing letters to their president or their president-elect? I mean, I know I did it when I was a kid. My teacher had us write letters to Reagan, and we liked him, and we thought he was cool, and we thought it was cool he kept jelly beans on his desk in the White House.
Are you at all nervous about drawing kids into politics, which, as we know, can get a lot rougher than a Dear President note?
Well, I think that's up to individual parents, and I think it depends on the age of different children. What I think is that what's important here is that we can hear from our kids and hear what they're thinking and hopefully send a message to the president-elect. You know, I think in doing this, I think it helps the kids because, as I say, it helps them feel empowered and that they're participating in their democracy. I've heard in a widespread way, it's really great for the grown-ups that are part of this page to see the letters, too, because they can see what's on kids' minds, and it's really inspirational to them, the way that kids are encouraging the president in this, you know, this highest office in the land to be kind in the way that they're doing that.
So is there a message to adults here in this project as well?
I think there is. I think that, number one, kids are pure. Kids call it as they see it, and I think that their letters can be really compelling, you know, that and the rainbows. But I think that, you know, what I'm trying to do is encourage people to be articulate, compelling communicators, because I think that the more that we can help people understand our stories and why this issue is important to us personally, that can draw connections more than further divide people. You know, adults in this country are really divided, and they're being really vicious to each other. And I think that this is an issue that I saw as something that we can all come together on. You know, I've heard from Republicans, I've heard from Democrats, we've had Trump voters join onto the page as members, and I think that's really an exciting thing that's moving in the right direction, that if we can get behind one thing, it's that our president has the power to inspire us and unite us if he's up for that, and we encourage him to do that. We encourage him to listen to these letters from kids, these pure messages from kids, encouraging him to be more kind to people, even if they're different than he is.
Seattle parent Molly Spence Saheb Jami started that Facebook page, Dear President Trump, Letters from Kids About Kindness. We're tweeting out a link to the page now, and you'll find messages like the one from 8-year-old Ruby, who says, children like me are watching you. In case you want to contribute, the rules are be under 18, keep the letter positive, mail it physically to the president-elect at Trump Tower in New York City. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Now, if you're following news of Donald Trump's incoming White House team, I'm sure you've heard the term alt-right for his White House strategist Trump hired Steve Bannon from the website Breitbart, which Bannon called the alt-right's platform. What is alt-right? Well, Breitbart ran an article that it called An Establishment Conservative's Guide to the Alt-Right. The authors described the movement as born out of the youthful, subversive, underground edges of the Internet. Provocative, isolationist, pro-Russian, anti-free trade, pro-masculinity, with a major strain of white separatism. In other words, a big movement with lots of meanings to hide behind. KUOW has decided to avoid using the basket term alt-right in favor of white supremacy or white nationalism. KUOW's managing editor, Kathy Ducharme, wrote a memo to staff saying alt-right doesn't mean anything and normalizes something that is far from normal, so we need to plain speak it. Yesterday, we shared that announcement on our website, and our social media producer, Bond Huberman, has followed your reaction. Hey, Bond.
Hey, Bill. We have gotten a lot of feedback on this story. I'm seeing journalists across the country tweeting about it, and among our own audience on Facebook and Twitter, with one or two exceptions, people online are telling us that this was the right decision. Some already felt the term alt-right was confusing. For example, Christiana writes, I'll confess, when I first heard the term, I thought it had something to do with computing. Meanwhile,
as in Alt-Shift-Tab,
exactly,
right?
Control-Alt-Delete.
Uh-huh.
Others felt it was misleading. Nathan commented, it conveys the absurd concept of an alternative right, as if they're just Republicans with goatees or something. Marge posted, for me, alt-right is like cozy slippers. This is not what these people are. Call them by their real names, neo-Nazis. Matthew commented, alt-right equals neo-Nazi plus corporate marketing. But overall, people are generally happy. We got lots of thumbs ups, you know, that they like that we took this seriously enough to talk about this decision publicly.
Mm-hmm.
Duryea tweets, the words we choose are important and over time do make a difference. And finally, on that same note, Seattle writer Lindy West shouted out to us in her column from The Guardian today. She writes of KOW's decision, quote, it's essentially just a change to the station's style guide, a mundane housekeeping decision that usually only matters to copy editors. But in this case, especially if more news outlets follow suit, it could have a significant impact. Words have power.
Thanks, Bond. We appreciate your words. We'd like to know what you think. So tweet at us, comment on Facebook, or you can email record@kuow.org. Speaking of words, perhaps you remember this scene from the movie A Christmas Story, when Ralphie's helping his dad change the car tire and the tray that's holding all the tire bolts gets knocked over.
There we go.
Oh, for one brief moment, I saw all the bolts silhouetted against the lights of the traffic, and then they were gone.
Oh, fudge.
Only I didn't say fudge. I said the word, the big one. The queen mother of dirty words, the F-dash-dash-dash word.
What did you say?
Why is saying the F-dash-dash-dash word so shocking to us? And at the same time, why do we find saying that and other swear words so appealing? Benjamin K. Bergen tried to answer those questions in his book, What the F? Bergen teaches cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego, and he told me the F word was not always a terrible word.
At the time of Shakespeare, it was kind of like screw. The competitor at the time that filled the role that the F word now fills was swive, which has totally fallen.
Get out of here, Benjamin. Get out! How dare you?
I didn't realize that you were 500 years old. I mean, I know that radio is an old art form, but So the F word has become more profane. It was decided probably by the 18th century that it was really not appropriate for diaries and letters of the upper class and so on. But it does have certain features that lend it some impact as a profane word in English, and it sounds like a lot of other profane words. You know, we talk about English profanity casually as four-letter words, and we do happen, that word, among others, we do happen to have a lot of profane words that are four letters long. But what they really seem to share is that they're one syllable, like the F word is, and they end with consonants, in particular, hard stop consonants, like k and t and so on. And these words that sound this way, that pattern this way for English speakers, sound more profane.
So the F word didn't used to be that bad, considered that bad. Now it is the convenient one-syllable hard-stop word to throw in all of our angst or something about why do we have to have a word that bothers us so much? You're a cognitive scientist. Mm-hmm. What's going on around that word that we're throwing our discomfort into it?
Well, the first thing to say is that we don't have to have a word like that.
So if that's interesting. Yeah. Are there cultures that don't even have a version of that?
Exactly. So if you look across the world, you'll find that not only are there languages and cultures that don't have that word, there are languages and cultures that don't have the concept of profanity, that don't have such a thing as a class of words that need to be bleeped if you're going over the public airwaves, for example. So Japan is such an example. There are lots of ways to insult a person in Japanese, but there aren't any words in that train of insults that you could let loose on someone that themselves are vulgar, that themselves are violations of a social agreement that we won't say these words in public. So there doesn't have to be such a thing as profanity. We just happen to have it and have it in spades.
What is profanity to you? Maybe everybody doesn't agree. What's profanity?
Well, there are words that a culture decides are inappropriate for certain sorts of settings. They're inappropriate for use. It could be around kids, it could be in public, it could be in formal situations. We decide that these are the bad words, not what they mean, but the words themselves. Those sequences of sounds used in that particular way, those violate a social norm.
But they are related to certain topics, right? Obviously, sex and religion figure prominently.
That's two of them. They also are often drawn from body parts and things that come out of them, and then also slurs, so terms of abuse for groups of people. Those are sometimes lumped together with the rest of profanity and sometimes not.
But you make a distinction, an important distinction between profanity and slurs.
That's right. So slurs, they behave somewhat differently. We actually know that slurs can cause harm. We know that they lead people to become more discriminatory in their behavior towards marginalized groups when just overhearing a slur. And we know that, at least from correlational studies, middle school kids who hear a lot of slurs directed at them over the course of their 6th through 8th grade years also report that they don't feel as connected with their school, and they report greater degrees of depression and anxiety.
But the research does not tell us that profanity, that cuss words, harm children, right?
That's right. The words related to sex or body parts or religion, there's no evidence whatsoever that outside of the context of verbal abuse, that these terms by themselves, whether you're stumbling over a piece of Lego or a child gate or something like that, that they will cause harm to children of any type, really.
Do you have kids, Benjamin?
I have a kid, yeah.
How old, if
he's,
I may?
He's 2.5.
2.5.
Yeah.
Do you or will you swear around that child?
I do and I will. I think as our discussion has kind of has illustrated, there are certain words that are known to cause harm, these slurs that denigrate people based on their ethnicity, religion, sex, sexual orientation, and so on. We know there are bad consequences of using those particular words. I don't use them, and I certainly don't use them around my kid. I don't want him to learn that it's normative to use those words. On the other hand, the rest of the stuff, you know, when I'm trying to cook and I spill boiling water on myself or something, I'm not censoring myself. And what my kid is going to learn is that when people are experiencing very strong emotions, there is a thing that they do linguistically. There is a set of words that they use to express those strong emotions. And it's not just bad emotions. It's also when I'm excited because the Chargers scored a touchdown against the Seahawks, for example, if that were to ever happen. you know, the kid is learning that there are words that have power and are used in moments of strong emotion. Now, the thing that he doesn't see and the thing that he has to have explained to him is the social norms. You know, that if he were to use this word at school, his teacher might not like it and there might be consequences. And that type of social learning is something that I feel he is best able to learn if I demonstrate the behavior that I want him to learn, and if I coach him on all the nuances that might be hard because the social world is invisible.
Do you think the world, Benjamin, would be even a little better place if the rest of us swore more than we do?
I don't know. You know, I'm not that kind of... I'm more of a scientist who describes rather
than... You're also a father who swears.
That's true. I can tell you it works for me. So in my household, I would feel less comfortable if I weren't myself in all of the ways that I'm myself at home. And, you know, I try not to harm my child, and this is a way that I believe I can be myself and not harm my child. I certainly don't think that there would be enormous harm or any harm at all caused by changes in censorship regulations that the FCC imposes on broadcast radio and television, or that the MPAA imposes on motion pictures. Like, if there were a lot more F words and SH words and so on in movies, I don't think that would make the world a worse place.
It would eliminate something I feel is dishonesty, when everybody knows what you're talking about, but you're pretending they don't. That bugs me.
You're not the only one. So my book is called What the F, and I didn't want that to be the title originally, right? For exactly that reason, because that big red F, it means something, and you're trying to have your cake and eat it too, right? You're trying to evoke this concept that everyone knows exactly what you're saying, and yet you're trying to play it off like, oh yeah, but you know, I'm being genteel about it. It feels a little false. I totally agree. On the other hand, we do live in a world governed by these social norms. In fact, by legal norms. So we can't swear right now into these microphones, have it recorded and broadcast, because your station will be fined. That is a consequence of that. That will happen. And so, and in the same way, advertisers, bookstores, for example, they shy away from the use of these words. And so there's this partial solution of abbreviating, you know, saying things like the F word or effin' this, or even using minced oaths like frickin'. These are...
Fudge, like in Christmas Story.
Right. For example, shut the front door.
Shut the front door. That one was kind of fun. I got it.
It's pretty good, right?
For a short time.
You know, these are solutions to a social problem, and we may not be comfortable with them, but for many purposes, they're really the only way that you can do the work.
But say your child doesn't pick up on all the nuances. Now you've raised a kid who's foul-mouthed, and it's your fault.
That's right. That's one of the big concerns that parents will often raise. If you swear around a kid, he's going to learn to swear, and that's going to reflect poorly on the child. He's going to be punished. That's going to be bad for his ability to succeed in school. It's going to look bad on you as a parent. You're not going to get elected to the school board. But guess what? The kid's going to learn those words anyway. It's not hearing you say it that's going to be the main impetus for him.
But I'm the role model.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And you are a role model who can exactly demonstrate the situations in which it is and the situations in which it is not going to elicit consequences, undesirable consequences, to use those words. Pretending that they don't exist or pretending that you don't know them is, well, it's kind of the same thing as abstinence-only education or other sorts of really unsuccessful ways to try to censor behavior that always end up producing more unbridled excitement for those very same behaviors that you're trying to stop.
You know, my gut is that just us talking about this like it's just a word and not all cultures feel the same and all this, just doesn't it seem to let the air out a little bit? Like, to make the whole profanity thing seem a little silly for grown-ups?
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, that's what the book is supposed to do, just turned up to 11, right? Once you start to not just treat the word as a word, but to treat it as an object of science that you can ask questions about, that you can study, that you can ask, how does it affect people's bodies? What happens to heart rate when you hear this particular word? You can ask, what part of the brain produces this particular word? Are there things to learn about how humans evolved language and how our brains manage to produce words without making lots and lots of mistakes that we can learn specifically from profanity? Then it becomes A, not a sort of fetish object like it has been, and not just deflated a little bit, but actually something of value, something that you can use as a as an instrument.
Cognitive science professor Benjamin K. Bergen from University of California, San Diego. His book is called What the F. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. The other F, Facebook, has been criticized lately for hosting and profiting from fake news items. Can you tell the difference between real news and sponsored ads from news articles? Can our children, can our college students tell the difference? We'll look into this issue coming up this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. This is a great time of year to be thinking about books. If you've got literary friends, books are gifts. If you have relaxed vacation time ahead, books are a pleasure. If you have more family interaction coming than you would like, books are a retreat. Our friend Nancy Pearl has a thing for science fiction and fantasy novels, and she says if you judge a book by its cover, you would think today's recommendation is science fiction.
You are thinking science fiction, and you would be right. At least that's where libraries seem to be shelving it and bookstores. It's called The Race. It's by Nina Allen. It's a first novel, although she's won many awards for her short stories. I had never heard of her. I picked up this book on a whim and just fell in love with it. I don't think it's science fiction, and here's why. This is really a collection of four short stories, longest short stories, with an afterword. And the short stories are tangentially related, but do not follow one upon the other. And it's set in a world that is very much like ours, but different. After some great accident has happened, this is the somewhat dystopian future that we're living in. But the main characters in each of the short stories are different. And this is not a book for people who want answers by the last page, because this is a book where I would say nothing is answered, and there is everything to think about when you finish it. I loved this book, and it was a revelation to me that somebody could write a book without a real plot arc in which everything is tied up neatly at the end. It's a book about language. It's a book about friendship and family and dogs who are modified so that the racing greyhounds have a little chip so that they're in constant communication with their runner. It's about the future, but it's not. It's about people and how mysterious people's lives are.
But I would say that aren't the best dystopian or sort of speculative fiction books about those big questions?
They are, but mostly they give some answers.
And there are none.
And there are none. I would argue there are none in this book. And that's what makes this book so special. And this is the kind of book that if you pick, if you're a science fiction fan, if you're a fan of Brandon Sanderson or Guy Gabriel Kay or Alistair Reynolds or Peter Hamilton, you know, from fantasy to science fiction, I don't think this is going to make you happy. I think that the people who are going to love this are people who like experimental literary fiction. And I like both of those genres. So I was happy with what I would have been happy however she did it. But boy, she did it so well.
This book is called The Race, and the author, Nina Allen's last name is spelled A-L-L-A-N. Sort of a novel, but really sort of four short stories and an afterword. It sounds intriguing.
It's wonderful, Marcy.
Nancy Pearl with KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman talking books as they do every week. And you'll find all of Nancy's recommendations at KUOW.org. I'm Bill Radke. Coming up this afternoon, Donald Trump refuses to accept the results of Saturday Night Live sketches. Traditionally, presidents have put up with satire. Comes with the job. We'll look into American political humor then and now. Coming up on KUOW's All Things Considered. Now, instead of just talking about all the new people coming to Seattle, our show has been introducing you to the flip side. People who are leaving Seattle are telling you how they thought it through and what they've learned. Dave and Dana Varellin loved Seattle. They had a strong community here. Dave played music in the city for years. Seattle changed. The Varellins changed. Their daughter was born in 2012. They started to think differently about their community and things like traffic. So they packed up and moved to Tacoma. And today they own their own business there, a bar, which Dave says would have been really hard to pull off in Seattle.
I think as a startup company, it was much easier to be in a location that was affordable. Lots of available spaces to choose from. And I think we kind of got to tackle it at our own pace as new business owners versus the pace of Seattle, which I think moves much faster and you have to have, you know, much more experience.
And more money.
And more money.
Yeah, we did it, you know, all ourselves, like no conventional lending or anything, just us and our business partner, Suzanne. And we did like a community source loan, and community as a whole in Tacoma, maybe because it's smaller, it's just so supportive. We depend on them, you know, like depend on like community.
How do you depend on them?
Like to show up, you know, like to show up when we open a new business, and we know that we can depend on a community of not just friends, but, you know, there's a community also of business owners where everything kind of has a face. There's not like a lot of corporate, you know, or like investor funded. It's a lot of like grassroots, like self-started. And, you know, when you go to a business, you know, like the face behind that business. And I always say too, like Tacoma shows up, you know, when you like ask them to or need them to, like they do. And it's been like really humbling, but also like we're incredibly grateful for like the people who we already were friends with, but the way that we've been embraced.
It's grown too. It's grown leaps and bounds since we've opened, and had the ability to meet so many of our neighbors that we didn't know before. But as soon as we start talking, we know three different people, you know, communally, and it's pretty interesting that way.
And what about Seattle? What you we talked about affordability, but what's the community feel in Seattle that you left?
Yeah, I had a really strong group of friends and musicians and businesses around here as well. And I don't know what happened, but Seattle changed, and it changed the way maybe we got older, or maybe the influx of new people into town changed the way it was, but we didn't all meet at the same place anymore and hang out all the time. And
why? You mean because you had kids, or because there's the Seattle change?
I don't know. Before we had kids, we kind of noticed it too. We all kind of just it took a lot of effort to get us out into downtown or Capitol Hill, where we used to live and hang out a lot. And it was a different scene. Again, maybe just age. I don't know, but. You know, a lot of my friends who still work at bars on Capitol Hill even let me know that it's changed quite a bit. Their clientele, kind of the scene and the people that they are meeting and you know, serving. And so for us, that change made it kind of easy to slip away, I think.
I mean, a part of it is like, you know, like in the bar business, we say like people turn 21 every day. So, you know, there's always like, like an influx of people that you don't know, that you've never seen before. And I think it's so concentrated here because there's so many people moving here. And while there are people moving out, I feel like for me, like maybe the people that move out are kind of like looking for the same things that we're looking for, like maybe a little bit more like minded than the people that are moving in.
So. I mean, every day we meet people in Tacoma that have moved down from Seattle. Every day at the bar, and they say, oh, we just moved into town and we're just checking things out. And we all have the same stories about feeling the squeeze out, feeling like you wanted to be in a place where you could rent a studio for your art space project, or you could, you
buy
know,
a home.
Buy a home for your family or start a small business, and it wasn't going to, you know, immediately bury you in debt. And so it's funny to have these stories with all those people, you know.
You mentioned the idea of people being like-minded. I know people who like the diversity of a big city, that we're not all like-minded. Is that not you?
No, I think there is diversity. Maybe it's just still real regional. I don't know. I mean, the regions that the areas of the town that we hang out in, excuse me, are very similar in thoughts and ideals, I think. And, you know, we're very open and welcoming community. It's funny. We always notice.
Homogeneous yet open and welcoming?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's funny because you could go into a bar and people next to you would talk to you in Tacoma. And you go into a bar in Seattle and people are like scooting away from you, like, don't enter my bubble. And so it's strange. You'd have a conversation with somebody you'd never known before and then you leave and you're like, oh, that's Tom, you know, and you'll see him next time. And it just kind of happened several mm-hmm. times to us.
Yeah, I think in Tacoma, I think for me, like-minded, I mean sort of like there's a pace, maybe not so much like a way of thinking, because Tacoma's as diverse as it comes, and you kind of like can't separate yourself from people as much in Tacoma because there's not 1,000 options. So uh-huh. like in our bar, we're in a gay neighborhood in Tacoma. So there's lots of gay people. There's people that are just 21. There's like 65-year-olds, every color, every walk of life, I think, because, you know, there's not a ton of places to go. So you end up being around people who you wouldn't necessarily be around when you have a lot of options where you could be like, okay, this is like a punk rock bar, or this is where like the, you know, whatever people are into, whatever, they hang out in this bar. And I think when there are those places that like certain populations kind of like take over as their bar, you end up not like seeing or being around as many people as you would as when, you know, there's 10 options.
Some listeners are hearing this saying, this sounds like paradise. Let's go to Tacoma.
I've heard that.
Yeah,
I've heard Tacoma's paradise from our customers, and people didn't realize, and I've heard that more. It's like, oh, I didn't realize how great it is, and there's lots of cool stuff down here. And, man, I've been to like four restaurants tonight, and they're all real good. And I'm like, you're surprised.
As if it's going to all be like KFC or something.
Right.
But aren't you bringing on a Tacoma boom right now? What are you doing to your city?
I know.
Well, that's also like a running joke with people in Tacoma is like, yeah, let people think it's dangerous. Like, let people think it stinks. Like, you know, like don't encourage anyone. But I think, you know, especially leaving Seattle, that if you want to stay close to Seattle or you want to buy a home, you don't have to go all the way to Tacoma. You know, so if you're moving to Tacoma, it's because there's something that you like and that you want to be around that's in Tacoma, because there's lots of places between here and there that are probably
just... Burien's nice. Burien's real nice.
Yeah, you stay close to Seattle. So I think that there's something specific there that people kind of find that they really like about it. And we have one of our bartenders, Joel, he and his wife moved to Tacoma maybe last year, and his wife always says, you know, like on our street, there's like a co-op and there's a pinball bar and there's a record store that just moved from a small location to a big location. You know,
versus like, a big location to a small location.
Like, there's an actual record store that just expanded, you know, like in Tacoma. And this is all like on a street that you can walk 2 blocks to and then, you know, walk for maybe 6 blocks, you know, and it's very accessible.
What do you want to say to our listeners who do live in Seattle and you're just telling them that their city is worse than a stinky paper mill?
It does sound like
I'm
that.
I'm sure not saying that.
This is your chance.
Yeah.
What's your message to the people of Seattle?
I think especially for the people who aren't maybe originally from around here that are living in Seattle now, anytime you go to a new place, you're the new guy, right? So you need to scrub up on your history. Maybe, you know, learn a little bit about the town and its history and its neighborhoods and its people, because those are all deeply rooted things. And it's difficult to embrace change, I think, for the locals that are having to embrace a lot of change with the new population that's coming into town. And so I feel like know where you're moving to and learn about it a little bit and embrace it. You know, you have to embrace, like, your surroundings here, because I don't think Seattle's going to change. I think Seattle's going to change people that come here, and I hope that's the case, because it's a great city. I'm sure if we had the Mega Millions in our back pocket, we would live here. You know what I mean? But we don't. So that's
not yet.
We're trying.
The Varellans, that was former Seattleites Dave and Dana Varela, now owners of the Zodiac Supper Club in Tacoma, reminding you that you don't have to leave the Puget Sound area just because Seattle's not fitting you right anymore. Tacoma is paradise. This is a series of conversations with people leaving Seattle. We've met people who've gone to the desert, gone to bigger cities. They can tell you about the trade-offs, so take a listen at our website, KUOW.org. I'm Bill Radke. Finally, your Thanksgiving might include some chit-chat with family members you don't agree with. And boy, do you have a lot to disagree with after this election. So, will your Thanksgiving sound like this?
Dear Lord, thank you for this Thanksgiving holiday and for letting us white people kill all the Indians and steal their tribal lands and stuff ourselves like pigs, even though children in Asia are being napalmed.
Okay. Jesus, enough, all right.
Or will your family gathering sound more like this?
I think everything looks really nice.
Me too. It's going to be a really nice Christmas.
Thanks, Portlandia. Maybe the Christmas spirit will grace your Thanksgiving table. A team of KOW producers went down to a University District coffee shop to ask people how they are approaching holiday discord this year. Here's Julie Fisk telling you about her family dynamics.
Well, I'm from Texas, and my family's all from Texas and in Texas, and they are red-blooded Republicans and proud to be such, and I am a Democrat, so I'm the blue sheep in the family.
So what do you do when you disagree with your family?
Drink? No. Well, with my dad, since he's the one that I speak with most of the time, I like to ask him questions to figure out why he thinks the way that he does, and not necessarily coming out and saying you're wrong to feel that way or you're terrible to feel that way, but just really figuring out why he feels that way. And I think that that helps him to feel heard and helps him to not feel like he's being attacked, which is a big thing. And I learned that because when I was a teenager, I used to attack him, and that shut us down really quickly. And so now that I'm older, I've learned to kind of step back and be a little bit more gradual in my approach to things with him. Yeah.
That was Blue Sheep Julie Fisk in Seattle telling you how she approaches conversations with her family during Thanksgiving. So what about you? What are you afraid to talk about during the holidays with family? What would you say if you could? We're giving you a chance. Give us a call, 206-221-3663. Leave us a message. Maybe we'll play it on the air. 206-221-3663. Contentious Thanksgiving might be a good time for one of the cuss word substitutes we were discussing, Bond. The author of What the F was telling us about fudge and frickin' and shut the front door. So we asked for listener substitutes.
Yeah, so on Twitter we heard... Mother Fluffernutter? Or how about biscuits and gravy? Or just biscuits?
Yeah, if you like biscuits, that's good. There, a lot of them came in. We got Piffle, which my mom would approve of. Yeah. Thanks for all your excellent ideas. We're on Twitter at KUOW. And thanks for tuning in today on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information.